to On The Mic Podcast. This is your host, Tim Drake. On today's episode, we have comedian Julian McCullough. Julian is in town at Club 50 West this weekend with four shows Friday and Saturday at 7 p.m. and 9:30 p.m. Julian's best known for his work on Conan, the Late Show with Jimmy Fallon, as well as being a regular panelist on Chelsea Lately. He's also had a couple shows on Comedy Central, and there's just been a lot of awesome stuff in comedy. This is another mashup episode with Christopher James from the In Movie Nerds We Trust podcast. Christopher and I are loving teaming up on some of these for episodes over at Club 50 West. Both of us do a lot of work with the club, and it's been a fun way for us to even, you know, get to know each other better and collaborate and work with, you know, just some amazing comedians. It was a lot of fun talking with Julian last night after the first show. And finding out a little bit more about him. You know, I've seen his appearances on some of the late night shows. I've always really enjoyed his comedy, so it was fun to, you know, see him perform live and sit down and kind of find out, you know, where his upbringing was. So I learned a little bit about, you know, how he first started his career out in New Jersey and in New York, working his way up at the Comedy Cellar, and kind of how that whole process works, and some of the comedy that influenced him at a young age, and, you know, kind of what made him realize that comedy was the career path that he was going to take. So, of course, since this was a mashup with In Movie Nerds We Trust, we also talked about one of Julian's favorite movies, Down by Law, a movie that Christopher and I had both never seen before. But after Julian kind of told us how everything goes in the movie and we pulled everything up to learn a little bit about it, I'm thrilled to sit down and watch this movie this weekend. We found out it was available on Hulu, so it is going to be something I'm going to check out. He compares it a lot to a little bit more artsy version of Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? Still the same type of comedy elements to it, so I'm really looking forward to watching this movie. It sounded absolutely hilarious, so I'm really looking forward to checking it out and seeing what Down by Law is all about. As I said, Julian is in town right now in Salt Lake City. Kicked off his first show last night. That's, of course, what we talked to him after that show. So then he has two more shows tonight, Friday, November 13th at 7 p.m. and 9:30 p.m. And then tomorrow, Saturday, November 14th, 7 p.m. and 9:30 p.m. Get on out and support him. You know, his comedy is absolutely fantastic. Show's being hosted by Jason Harvey. I know a lot of the locals absolutely love Jason. So get out and support this show. A lot of great comedy. Plus, Club at 50 West is just an amazing club. They are so much fun to work with and such a great venue for just entertainment, period. Not just comedy, but all entertainment. So they do a lot of awesome stuff. And it's time to get out and, you know, see one of the newest, hottest clubs in Salt Lake City and see a lot of the great comedians that they are bringing through. So this episode is also sponsored by an event that I'm going to be hosting at Club at 50 West this coming week. Sean Wickard, who we've been working on the documentary Sean Wickard, Cursed and Cured, his book, Impossible or So They Said, is released this coming Tuesday, and we're doing an awesome book event down at Club at 50 West. Sean's going to be speaking at the event. We also have an Olympic bobsledder who's a gold medalist that's going to be speaking at the event. A three-time world record holder that's speaking at the event, and then for some reason I'm part of that lineup. But it's gonna be a lot of fun. I'm really excited to be hosting and moderating this event. And if you haven't heard Sean's story and you're here in Salt Lake City, this is an amazing experience to be able to come out and listen to Sean tell his story. As you know, he was paralyzed from the chest down for 8 years. Has spent almost 12 years, you know, having to use a wheelchair. And then after being one of the first in the world to receive a rare stem cell transplant from his own stem cells, he's walking, he's cured. So he also at the same time had lupus, completely cured of lupus. So he has just an amazing story that I think everybody just needs to know. And get out and come see this. Tickets are only going to be $5. So, you know, you can't go wrong there. Plus, you can pick up the book and have Sean sign it, be able to talk with Sean. He's really looking forward to seeing everybody out the show. So please, come on out. Huge thank you to Julian for taking the time. I always kind of felt bad when we kind of, you know, sit down right after a comedian finishes a set and sit down and talk to them for another hour after they just did an hour on stage. But it was a lot of fun. Between me, Julian, and Christopher, we just had a blast together. So it was kind of sad to see that hour come to an end, and kind of look forward to being down at the club a little bit more this weekend and getting to know Julian a little bit better and enjoying his comedy. But yeah, if you're in Salt Lake, get down there this weekend. Tickets are, I believe, $15 at the door, so you're not going to want to miss this show again. You've seen Julian on Conan, Fallon, Chelsea Lately, Comedy Central. Get out there, support great comedy. Hope you guys enjoy this episode, another mashup episode with Christopher James of In Movie Nerds We Trust with comedian Julian McCullough.
joined with the On The Mic podcast host, Mr. Tim Drake.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
Thanks
for coming
back.
I'm like sitting like Peter Pan.
Yeah?
Like I felt really awkward about that, all this pirate talk that we were having beforehand.
And as a chubby man, you have no happy thoughts.
No, I don't. Well, there's happy thoughts.
I thought you only had happy thoughts.
Maybe that's true.
They come and go. I mean, they're fluctuating because you get the depression because you're just like, I'm fat as fuck. I should kill myself.
Or
KFC.
Yeah. There you go.
It doesn't work for me since I am a vegetarian.
This is a commercial for our new sponsor, KFC.
Are you fat and have hopes?
Or KFC.
It's finger looking good.
I know I haven't been introduced yet. I'm sorry. I broke the podcast protocol.
Fine. Well, our special guest is here, headlining Club at 50 West, Julian McCullough. You know,
hello,
sir.
I will pretend that there was applause.
There's always applause in your heart.
Thank you. What?
You got to drink your beer now. There was applause.
Yeah, right. Julian, you're headlining the show from Friday to Saturday here at Club 50
West.
Yes,
absolutely. Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about yourself. I'm going to ask you the typical question that I ask all my fellow comedians. How long have you been doing comedy? What got you into it? The basics, as they will.
I've been doing comedy about there's two stages to stand-up comedy. There's how long you've been doing it and how long you've been making a living at it.
True.
I did it for about 6 years before I made a living. I started in New Jersey at a club called the Stress Factory Comedy Club in New Brunswick. I was going to Rutgers University at the time when I was 20 years old, and I found that there was a club in town, and I couldn't believe it. And I got a job there seating the room. I worked there to hone my craft for 5 or 6 years, and it took a long time. I think I spent more time developing than most people tend to before they move to a big market, because when you work at a club, you see we were an hour from New York City, so all the headliners were like the best headliners working. You know, it was like, at the time, it was Patrice O'Neill and Greg Giraldo and, you know, like the whole Tough Crowd crew. And then also Brian Regan would come through before he did theaters. And, you know, it was like it was kind of amazing, you know, what I got to see. Plus, you think about all the features and all the MCs you would see. So every week I saw, you know, an hour and a half of jokes. And I was like, I can't talk about any of this stuff because it's all done. So it really limited my writing watching comedy every week, because I was like, I don't want to do what everybody else is already talking about.
Yeah.
That's what a young person thinks. I now realize that we have 5 topics and whoever is the funniest wins. That's all that matters. You know what I mean? So anyway, so I did that for like 5 years, and then I broke into New York, and you know, I got into the Cellar before any other club, which is insane. Breaking into New York City is like the worst thing in the world. And
okay.
I mean, it's just like so hard.
Yeah,
it's so
yeah,
hard.
Yeah.
And the Cellar at the time, especially now, it's not. Now they're much more open to like up and coming people. But at the time, it was like the old guard. So there were no people really under 30 when I got in.
Did someone self-devouch for you in those days?
Yeah, that's still the only way. Is a comedian that's a regular that the booker Esty trusts says, you know, hey, there's this kid that I saw and you should at least watch him. And then you get an audition that's 5 minutes on a Friday night at like 12 midnight. And so I was performing at the Stress Factory. I was hosting a weekend, and Kevin Brennan, who a lot of people probably don't know in the circles that you run in, but he's a kind of a road dog from a while back, but he's a New York based guy. Neil Brennan is his younger brother who co-created the Chappelle Show. Kevin is so fucking funny. Like, he's so funny. When Invite Them Up, I don't know how comedy historians you are, but like Eugene Merman and Bobby Tisdale had Invite Them Up at Rafifi in New York City years ago. That was like the beginning of the alt scene, you know, like right after Luna Lounge, it was like Rafifi. And I remember getting into a fight in Rafifi with these fucking up-and-coming alt kids. Oh, and I go, Kevin Brennan's hilarious. And they go, ugh. They were like, are you? No, he's not. And I'm like, you're out of your fuck. You think reading a notebook and drawing a fucking diagram like Dimitri Martin is funny? Watch a real comedian like Kevin Brennan. And it was like this huge fight. Todd Barry walks in just then. I go, Todd, isn't Kevin Brennan funny? And Todd gave a fucking dickhead Todd Barry response that I still don't remember. But the point is that those very comedians, years later, when they learned to appreciate stand-up and weren't just idolizing the heroes that they thought were great at the time, like Zach Galifianakis and those guys at the time, who, by the way, are great. But you know when you're a kid and you're like into certain bands and you're like,
yeah,
no other band is cool. Yeah. My band's cool. Like, that's what I was dealing with. Anyway, they ended up working with Kevin Brennan, and they were like, he's the funniest dude in the world. And it's like, you know, maturity lets you realize that, like, timing and, you know, all that stuff also matters. You don't have to be the most original fucking dude in the world, but, you know, whatever. So I saw a huge variety. I saw alt acts. I saw headliners that could make it. I saw Mike Birbiglia headlined the Stress Factory when he was 26. You know, and it, you know, so it was a cool, fertile ground. So then I get into the cellar because Kevin Brennan is a misanthrope, and he told Esty, hey, that you should watch this guy. And Esty was like, you never help anybody. You're a piece of shit. So this kid must be funny. So I get a phone call, and she was like, come in. She's Israeli. And she's like, I hear you're funny from Kevin Brennan. Do you want to come this Friday night at midnight and perform for me? And I said, yes. And I was working, but I told the club owner, I was like, I have an audition to the cellar. And he was like, go. So I went, and I had to follow. It was a showcase show. It was Greg Giraldo, Tom Papa, Jim Norton, me, and then Colin Quinn, I think. And like, so it was like that kind of lineup.
Yeah.
And me in the middle for 5 minutes. And I just did the five. I didn't deviate. I didn't like take any risks. I was like, this is the stuff that works, and it's worked for 6 months. And I just like did it as a script and got off early. I got off at like 4:30. And she appreciated that.
Yeah.
And as when I was upstairs, and she was like, so what else have you done? Like, are you in the other clubs? And I was like, no. Basically, I've done nothing. And Dave Attell walked by, and he goes, oh, Esty, this is Julian. He's really funny. And that was like he like kind of cemented like how she already kind of felt.
Yeah.
And then she's like, give me your avails. And then I started working there. And that was like my break into like actual stand-up comedy was that, you know. So it's like that kind of confluence of events where – when young guys say, how do you get started? You got to have that 5 minutes that's going to crush no matter where you are.
Yeah.
And no matter, it's got to be bulletproof because everybody gets one shot. Everybody gets at least, it doesn't matter who you are. You'll get one shot to be in front of the right person. And if you don't deliver, who knows how long it could take you to get another one.
Yeah.
So have that, you know, and it worked out for me. So that was nice. And then I worked the cellar for, you know, in New York.
And it led to a lot of great things. Doing, you know, Jimmy Fallon.
That's where I got really funny, yeah.
Oh, yeah. The cellar kind of helped bring you up.
The cellar made me realize, like, what the business, how much comedy was out there. Like, you know what I mean? Like, the cellar, the Stress Factory was like, oh, there's literally a million jokes. I'm not going to write an original joke. But that's where I decided to become personal because I was like, I can't write about taxis. Like, I'm not gonna write a better joke than Ben Bailey, so I'm not gonna, you know. So I became very personal, and then the cellar was like the every night, twice a night in the city, and that's where you get actually funny, where you're like, you know, polished. So
yeah, it's that whole 10,000 hours theory. Mm-hmm.
Malcolm Gladwell, brilliant.
Yeah,
brilliant man. He's basically the Steve Jobs of books.
I think, too, I mean, once you get into those big clubs that are making, you have to think and have to focus on writing a new bit each time. It gets you realizing everything that you do have to pull from where, yeah, I mean, every comic joke, yeah, you go to an open mic, and how many masturbation jokes are there going to be tonight? Yeah. Or how many abortion jokes? Because it's the cheap, easy joke. It's their go-to. But I know when I had even started with Second City, and the first teacher I had was like, all right, you're going to be churning out all these sketches. I'm like, how do I write that many sketches?
Yeah.
Like, and then by the end of that term, I was just like, holy shit, I wrote a bunch of sketches, and three of them are good.
Well, that's the thing.
But it starts making you think on
you can't
how
be
you can
precious
just
about
them
it. And
yeah.
You just got to, yeah. But, you know, I think about this all the time. I would never want to develop as a stand-up ever again. It was such a painful experience getting good. It sucks. It sucks so hard getting good. It takes forever, and there's so much failure. You know, and every time you think you're good, you're not. You know what I mean? You're like, oh, I'm good now. And then something happens, and you're like, I'm not good. And then when am I going to stop feeling like it was probably, you know, you always hear it's 10 years, but you don't believe it. You're like, I won't take 10 years. Everybody else takes 10 years. I'll take, you know, whatever. But it's probably I stopped counting by 10 years. You know, that's the other thing. It's like by the time it matters, you don't care anymore.
Yeah.
Or whatever. You know what I mean? Like by the time you are good. You stopped counting is like the only. There's that scene in Swingers. I don't know if you guys remember Swingers.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Where he's like, why won't she call?
Yeah.
And he says, there's. You're acting like you don't care. She can still tell you don't care. You are acting. Once you finally don't care, she will call, but you won't care anymore.
Yeah.
And he's like, that's supposed to make me feel better. And he's like, I mean, that's just the truth. But that's the deal is like in comedy, like by the time you're actually good, you don't care anymore because you've been through so much shit. You're just like, yeah, I fucking better be good. Like you don't, you stop count. You stop keeping score because,
yeah.
No, you know. So by the time I never bombed anymore, it'd been so long since I bombed, I forgot the last time I bombed, and then now you're good. That's like, yeah. You know. But it's not like a night where you're like, I did it. I crossed the finish line, and I'm funny now. Like, that never happens.
It's the stand-up comedy punch card. You're like, 10,000.
Yeah, exactly. 10,000 hours.
Oh, man. There are times when I teeter-totter myself where I'm like, oh, I had a great night. And then I'll go do an open mic the next time, and I'm like, wow, I should probably walk into traffic and just save everybody.
Well, open mics, though, you're also making the wrong people laugh. You're making other comics laugh, which is, like, never going to – there's a balance. It's tough. There's no easy answer. It's all a gray area, and it all sucks. We should all just kill ourselves. Like, that is – I'm not kidding. We should all eat 46 Krispy Kreme donuts and then just blow our brains out.
It's just a mass suicide of all the comics. What was that one in like San Diego in like the 80s or whatever? That big mass suicide cult that
guy
was just like, there's been so many. What are you talking about? How do you kill yourself in San Diego? It's like the most beautiful. How do you convince? That's a good.
I don't want
leader.
This optimal temperature anymore.
Koresh did it in Waco, Texas, which I totally understand because everybody's like, "What the fuck are we doing?" And he's like, "Follow me to heaven." And I'm like, "Great." San Diego, there's like surfing, there's rollerblading,
yeah, there's everything.
I mean, there's an aquarium,
those beautiful women everywhere.
What
you look?
The fuck are you gonna kill yourself for?
I remember I saw the big thing in the Museum of Death, and I was just like, this is the craziest thing. Like, they all put, like, blankets over their face and then, like, had a letter that, like, they were prepared for the afterlife. It was the craziest thing I've ever seen.
Wasn't that the Halley's Comet one? They did the same thing, kind of?
Yeah.
What was the Nike's one?
That's the Halley's Comet
one,
yeah.
The same one, okay.
They all got Nikes. If we're getting into heaven, we better have good kicks.
Yeah. It's weird Nikes didn't appropriate that for their ad campaign.
They utilize that? Like, hey. It's good advertising. Look at that.
And then
the next one's just Jordan jumping over
a
comet.
It's a close-up of somebody in Nikes climbing the stairway to heaven. just do it.
Oh, it's so dark and I love
it. Oh, man, just do it is a great suicide slogan.
You don't need help.
Maybe that's a hidden meaning behind that fucking
the
suicide.
The swoosh is just dripping blood in the bottom of it, like a horror Nike.
The swoosh should be the Halley's Comet.
Oh, shit.
We're getting real nerdy.
We're getting
about
like
this.
Really tinfoil hat up in this place. Jesus. Holy shit, Nike did it. It was their corporate advisors. I knew it. They staged the whole fucking thing.
That was just how they did layoffs at that time.
Yeah.
You're fired. Go drink this Kool-Aid and wear your Nike shoes in all black. Otherwise, we'll kill your family.
But I feel like I didn't talk about myself enough yet.
Go ahead.
When I was the real answer, that was all the logistics.
Yeah.
The real answer is, and I don't know where this comes from, and I feel like I don't know how. I actually don't know how many comics feel this way about being funny. But since I was like 5, I remember trying to actually make people laugh and thinking, this is all I care about and my only identity. And everything else is like cake, you know? Like if I can also be cute or if I can also be smart or if I can also have money, that's great. But my thing is that I'm going to make people laugh at like literally 5 years old. I don't. And so the first thought walking into any situation, doesn't matter what it is, a party or a class or a hospital, whatever it is, your first thought is, what's the funny thing that's happening right now? And that's the brain of a comedian. It's like, that's the only thing you care about first. And then after that, you're like, feelings and compassion and shit like that. But like, the first thing is what's funny right now. And I've had that brain since like before. That can't even be from my parents because that's not even, they weren't like that. So I think it's like, that's like, if you don't believe in God, there's a good, C.S. Lewis. I'm just going to take over this whole podcast.
Go for it, man.
C.S. Lewis wrote a book called Mere Christianity.
Yes.
And in it, he said that proof that God exists is that we all have a sense of morality that wasn't taught to us. Like, we're so, even when we're young, we know the golden rule. We know that people, other people deserve to be treated the way that we want to be treated. And it doesn't come from your parents, and it doesn't come, it's coming from a place that no one knows where it comes from, because it's from God. And so I have that with funny. And so I believe that is like, you know, that's like why it's so fucked up when people are like, you shouldn't be gay. It's like, well, we're born with a certain amount of shit that is like there from us, for us from day one. And
yeah.
You can't change it. And so, you know, I wish I could have taken life more seriously because I would be making more money today. But I, you know, I can't. I just, that's all I care about is what's funny first. And now that I'm 36, I actually am starting to finally give a shit about other, like, I finally don't worry about what's funny first.
And yeah.
It's a relief. It doesn't make me feel like I'm less of a comedian. It makes me feel like, oh, I'm more of a human being, you know? So that's nice. But if you don't have that thing where you're like, the first thing you think of all the time is what's funny about this, then you don't have the mind of a comedian.
Yeah.
That's how I look at it.
No, I've been the same way since I was 5. I'd always get joy out of getting kicked out of a class. Like, when I was like, you know, joking around and shit, I'd be like, oh, I guess I'm killing, clearly, because the teacher is telling me to get the
whatever
fuck out.
Whatever price I'm paying yeah. is secondary.
Yeah.
I would do that with impressions at that age.
Oh, yeah?
So I couldn't not go into a room and try to whip out an impression. I can't do them for shit now. I probably couldn't even then.
No, I thought you were great at it at yeah. 5.
But I would get kicked out of every class all through high school just because I had to try and be funny and do some type of stupid voice. And one of my friends, he was a student body officer, so he never got any of the shit. But he could do impressions and stuff at the time too. And we would just sit there and just go back and forth all day, and then I'd get kicked out. But I was happy because I was like, I made people laugh.
Yeah.
Now I'm in the hall. There's
yeah,
no one
like,
out here to make laugh.
These idiots think I feel punished.
Yeah.
They don't know that laugh yeah, that made me not want to kill myself for 2 weeks.
Yeah. Getting kicked out, that was the mic drop.
Yeah. I used to always want to make my mom's friends laugh, and I love just making them like crack up and shit, and they were drunk bikers, so it was an easy crowd.
Oh,
like,
yeah,
so.
They're the best.
Yeah.
Drunk biker women are the best. When I grew up in the... my parents were like, beatniks is a weird word, but they were, you know, they were into like, they were hipsters before that was really a term.
Yeah.
Or like the old definition of hipster, you know?
Yeah.
Where like, they were culture snobs with no money, you know? That's okay. All I grew up with. Where like, if you wanted money or nice things, you were like a bourgeois piece of shit. Like, I was 5 and I was like, ooh, can we get a color TV? And they're like, what have you painted today? like, nothing. So we would go to parties in San Francisco and, you know, everybody's wearing a black turtleneck and fucking, you know, talking about Bukowski. And there were these 5 women around that were like in mid-30s that obviously chose art over family or whatever. And so I was I was the only child besides my sister at this whole adult party. So they were just like swarmed around me because I was very talkative and very funny. And one of them said, you're so cute. And I remember premeditated. This is the first joke I ever told that I remember where I go, my mom said I could sleep over. And they laughed and I went, this is it. This is like, you know. So I banged that lady. And then, I remember that moment like it was yesterday. That was like my defining like, oh, I don't feel like a child. I feel like I am part of these people, you know?
Yeah.
It's a very powerful feeling.
Sure. And, you know, I don't know. I agree with you. I just love making people laugh in general. Even now, like, I don't give a shit. If I'm having a shitty day, I'm still going to walk into a room and say, hey.
I can't stop myself. Yeah. It's really annoying. I'm better to do it now. Like, I don't make every waitress laugh anymore because that was like, that's annoying for everyone at the table. But I'll do it every once in a while still for myself. If I'm alone, I'll do it. But I don't turn it on anymore in public because that's the other thing. It's like once you've been a comic for a long time, that's like making a living. You are like, I did it. Like, I don't need to prove every day to everyone that I'm a funny person, you know? But I do. I was definitely like that for a long time. I was that obnoxious kid that was just like, you know, always killing at driver's ed.
So. Well, you mentioned like, when you were a kid, what your first moment you felt like, oh, this is when I should start doing it. What moment in your career were you like, holy shit, I feel like this is what I want to do no matter what. I'm not going to stop.
It's a different, I would alter your phrase too.
Sure.
Now it's been so long, I can't stop.
There you go. All right.
I can't. I'm so old now.
It's
that
just perpetual
I can't
motion.
Go back.
Yeah.
I mean, literally, I can't. What am I going to be a fucking architect at 28? I can't go back. No, but it was. I used to think it was embarrassing. Now, that's the best part about being in your 30s is nothing's embarrassing. You don't give a shit anymore. You're like, yeah, I have a broken dick. Like, who cares? But it just means I fucked good. But I used to be embarrassed to admit that 8 years into stand-up, I still thought about quitting every day. You know? And I didn't think anybody else did. I thought I was the only one that was like, man, I feel like it's so fucking stressful. But I was like, I was on the track. Like, this was after I did Montreal New Faces. This was after I did Live at Gotham, you know, and all that. And I'm still like, I could quit any day now because this is just so hard. And you get to a point where, yeah, it kind of becomes a combination of, well, I guess technically I did make 10 grand more this year than last year. And I'm older. And so I'm getting farther away from a choice of, like, I'm just, like, backing into this fucking corner of being a stand-up. And it seems to not be going terrible. And I'm, like, I still haven't starved to death. I haven't gone to bed without dinner. So, yeah. You know. So it's like, that's the thing. Everybody wants to hear, like, that. That's why people love biopics. You know,
yeah.
Like, those fucking Walk the Line, which, by the way, is an amazing movie, but. Because they love seeing that moment. They always show that moment in the biopic where, like, they made it, and it was that profession from there on out, and there was no looking back. Like, that's not what life is like. You
yeah.
look back forever.
Yeah.
You know? And you're like, this might be a huge mistake. You know? But
even at 30, though, I started looking back and was just like, man, I fucked up a lot.
Yeah.
But then at the same time, I look back at, I mean, even just in the last couple of years, I'm just like, I felt like that was a fuck up 2 years ago, but where I'm at now, I never would have reached that point
yeah.
had I not fucked up 2 years ago.
Yeah.
Because it became
thing.
The biggest driving point.
People that don't get over their parents, it's like, get over your parents, because wherever you are, like, if you're at all happy or you have anything to feel good about, you're just a result of what you've done, what happened to you before. And so you can't get. It's weird. It's like, you know, because a lot of my friends did the traditional route and, you know, are architects or whatever now. And I always felt self-conscious. Like, I was the weirdo that was like, I'm going to be alone and do this thing. And, you know, hopefully it works out. And you all kind of secretly feel sorry for me. And, but you get to a point where you wake up one day and you're like, oh, I'm in a hotel in Salt Lake City. And most people don't get to do this on a Thursday. They
yeah.
don't get
yeah.
to just, like, fly to Salt Lake City for a Thursday. And now I'm in a – there was – you know, there weren't a whole lot of people out there tonight, but I had a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And I was in a city I haven't been in a long time. And it's a different environment. And there's – I could say, oh, I wish I'd studied more in high school. But then maybe I'd be somewhere not performing for 12 people in Salt Lake City. And that would be sad. I liked it. I
yeah.
had fun, you know. So – you can't get mad about, like, anybody that looks back and goes, like, and blames their past or whatever. It's like, you know, you're not being grateful for where you are. And it's like, there's nothing, no other combination of things could have brought you here. I'm a very,
yeah.
I'm into the universe and shit. So
no,
I apologize
I feel,
for
yeah.
being like
yeah.
a hippie girl from Bonnaroo.
No, it's fine.
I had fun pointing out to my mom just the other day, because my entire family has gone down the very traditional route. And I pointed out to her, I was like, you realize, like, for Christmas and stuff, like, my brothers were getting, like, the human body and, you know, a chemistry set, and you guys bought me the Smothers Brothers, and mm-hmm. like, where the hell did you think I was going to go compared to them? Like, you
so
were
it was up to them, kind of, or they could yeah. tell early on that you were into that kind of shit.
I don't even know. They were just giving it to me, but then when it came down to, like, oh, you're getting older, you need to take a career seriously.
Yeah.
I'm like, really?
Oh, weird.
These guys made a lot of money.
It sounds like they were nervous new parents for your siblings,
yeah.
and then when you came along, you're like, let's just.
I'm
don't
the
feel like
well, I'm the oldest.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. I'm the oldest.
Oh, so they fucked up and they were like, oh, we got to
yeah.
get more serious with you.
He yeah. was the test child.
Yeah.
Just kick him under the rug. We'll start with a new one. I was in like the throwaway bin at like.
I guarantee you, I wouldn't want to be hanging out with your siblings though, and you seem fun, so it's fine.
I feel the same way. My mom like let me listen to comics when I was a little kid, like dirty comics like Carlin and shit. And then once I got older and started getting into that stuff, and I knew what I wanted to do, they're like, "Oh, we're gonna take your sisters to dance and all this shit, and make them, you know, be a good part of society. They're doing hobbies." And I'm like, "Oh, well, maybe I should do like junior jazz or something." And they're like, "No." My mom's like, "No, we're going to spend all this money on your sisters." They have a future.
Luckily, there's no school for stand-up.
I remember seeing my brother watch like Thomas the Tank Engine back in the day when Carlin was the conductor on there.
And
oh,
was he?
God, yeah.
I didn't know
he
that.
He was the conductor before Ringo was.
Wait, Ringo was
yeah,
the... Wait, Thomas the Tank Engine goes yeah. back that far?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't
yeah,
know
it was
that.
Carlin
it's a BBC
was the conductor.
Show, isn't it? Or no?
PBS show. Yeah, PBS. Yeah. But yeah, Carlin and Ringo were the conductors.
I had no idea, because I have a daughter, so I don't know about Thomas the Tank.
But I remember seeing that. My brothers were just having, I was like, that dude shouldn't be a kind of kid's show.
Yeah.
Granted, I was only 7, but I knew who Carlin
was. Well, David
was.
Bowie shouldn't have been the Goblin King, but, you know, you deal with it.
That was like Lawrence Fishburne being the, like, cartoon cowboy on Pee Wee Herman.
Yeah. Or Pee Wee Herman being Pee
Wee
Herman.
Granted, you watched Pee Wee's early
that
HBO specials, and that was not necessarily meant for kids.
Dude, that was never meant for kids.
It was a Groundlings character that he created.
I know, it's such a shame.
I know, and his first like feature, like star, like big role is when he was in Cheech and Chong, like playing his Pee Wee Herman character, which is insane.
I don't remember that. I never got into Cheech and Chong. My dad liked them, and I never got into Cheech and Chong.
My mom did too. Clearly, my mom was not a great parent. You know, drunk biker. Hey, son, you're 4. Watch these stoners talk about dicks.
Yeah.
Which is probably why I turned out less fucked up as opposed to the crushing, you know, weirdness of religion. You know?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's a big deal here.
To say the least.
Yeah. I mean, if the choice is biker or Mormon, I mean, you know, flip a coin. That's how I look at it.
Either way, you'll end up wearing a vest.
Either.
You quick motherfucker.
The only store in Salt Lake City doing gangbusters has been the vest store for 50 years. Vests R Us has been crushing it.
Whether you're a biker or a Mormon, here at Benson's, we'll treat you right for over 50 years.
Where'd you come up with Benson's?
I don't know. I got possessed.
I'm thinking of like a red carpet where it's like who wore it vest, and it's like a biker wearing a leather vest and then a Mormon wearing a very like a 3-piece suit vest.
Then somewhere Cameron Esposito comes in. She's like, "Fuck you all, I wore a vest." I wore
a
vest.
It's a denim vest.
Oh, my God. Have you ever had any insane moments during shows? That's one of my favorite questions to ask fellow comics is, because I know, like, I've had people try to give me tips at a urinal after a show, shit like that.
Yeah.
Someone tries to give you the tip at a urinal?
No, tips. Like,
wanted to clarify that.
Yeah, they're not like saying, "Here's the tip of my dick. You saw that mic near your mouth and I got really excited." No.
Craziest. Well, interestingly, the better you get, the less crazy shit happens during your show because you're in control. So, like,
gotcha.
Very few. It's like that thing where you let the, if you let the, if you give the animals the key to the zoo, they will run wild. But if you're like, "I'm the fucking zookeeper," and you're all in your cages, then nothing ever happens, right?
Yeah.
So that's kind of what it's like. As you get better at stand-up, fewer and fewer incidents happen. So most of your incidents that you're looking for happen in the first, you know, 5 years when you're like, you have no idea what you're doing on stage. But I will say my favorite story to tell about, like, a heckler that didn't mean it was I was in Milwaukee, and it was my first headlining gig, and I was so nervous and excited, and I couldn't believe I was the last guy, you know, and it was like the road, and I was like, wow, you know, and it was the club was a healthy club, so it was like it was a packed room, and it was great, even though they didn't know who I was, and I was killing for like a half an hour because I wasn't experimenting, I wasn't like loose yet, I was like, this is, you know, my material, and it was going great, and I was about a half hour in, and there was a table in the second row, and it was like mid-30s people, and one woman was like 89 years old at this table. So clearly it was like grandma's night out, and they didn't, you know, it wasn't like she really wanted to be there. You could tell just from the vibe, like, we didn't know what else to do. It was like they couldn't find a sitter. So half an hour into my show, she raises her hand, which is like not part of stand-up. But, and normally you don't answer that because it's, you know, but she was so old, I was like, this might be an emergency. So I go, yes, ma'am, is there a problem? And she goes, what do you do for a living? And she could not have been more sincere. She had no idea what stand-up comedy was. She had been listening to somebody talk for half an hour. The crowd was dying, but she didn't give a fuck. She was staring. There was literally a fern on stage. She was just staring at the fern the whole time. And that was like the most... That's what's great about stand-up. I was like a half an hour in. I was like, I'm doing it. I'm headlining. It's working. I'm good enough. I followed the feature and I'm doing better than him. And I'm like the real deal. And then midway through my show, a woman goes like, what is this that you're doing? And it was just like, that's the thing about stand-up is like, it's so humbling, you know, like I was still like, hopefully this, I don't know.
She's like, you're not Johnny Carson.
Yeah. No, she didn't even know, you know, that it was comedy that was happening. That's the best part.
She have dementia?
I don't know.
That fern took her back to a happy place in her childhood. She went really deep in that fern.
That was pretty funny. I mean, I've had like, you know, crazy shit happen that's like, would take too long to tell and stuff for my first 5 years, which doesn't even count. It's like, that's when you're, you know... I tried to raffle a Pop Warner Football League raffle one time and in New Jersey, and all the guys wanted to kick my ass after. But that's like not stand-up. You know what I mean? That's not like a regular show. So, but that was like the best out of the mouth of babes thing that ever happened, where a woman raised her hand midway through a killing set and asked me what I did for a living.
Well, even tonight was interesting too with those chicks and... the crowd who went with the whole van. And
they were nice. They were encouraging, you know. That somebody said, Mulaney said it in an interview recently, that they're not hecklers. They're participators. I forget the word he used. But it was like encouragers or something. Where they're not trying to disrupt the show. They're just excited.
Oh, okay.
Know? And so that's not, you can't call that a heckler. A heckler is like, you suck, you piece of shit. You
know? Yeah.
That's pretty rare. Well, it's rare for me, guys. I don't know.
No, that's how I wake up each morning. It's a text from my dad.
You'll never amount to anything. It's 8 a.m.
He's standing over your bed with his hand raised, and you're like, yes, sir, do you have a question? And he's like, you suck.
All right, we'll visit this again tomorrow morning.
He just shuffles in like Larry David, like, what the fuck do you do?
Huh? Wait, so this is a movie podcast, right?
Yeah.
Let's talk about movies.
Yeah, that's, you took the words out of my mouth.
Let's do it.
You were saying that your favorite movie is a 1986 classic, Down by Law.
Yeah, Down by Law. Tom Waits, directed by Jim... Tom Waits stars in it.
Yeah.
Jim Jarmusch directed it. John... don't tell me. Not Bertolini. What's his name?
Robert Benigni.
Yes. Life is Beautiful, that guy.
Yeah, right as I noticed that, I was like, oh, he's
John Lurie. John Lurie, yes. He was a jazz musician in the Lounge Lizards. This was back when if you were just like cool in the Lower East Side of New York, you got hired to do like classic cult films.
Yeah.
Like walking around town. That's how cool New York was back then. But yeah, it was those guys. And I don't know, I saw the movie in college, and it's a series of vignettes, essentially, about these three guys that escape a prison in New Orleans, and they're on the road to... It's almost like Oh Brother, Where Art Thou without any money or, you know. And it's just, there's certain scenes, like, Roberto Benigni has a scene in the swamp where he cooks a rabbit, and he's reimagining his life as a child, where his mom was bringing him a rabbit as a pet, and then he's now cooking that rabbit in the swamp in New Orleans because he's a criminal. And it's like one of the most laugh out loud. There's no one else around. He's literally doing it with a dead rabbit. And it's so funny and so heartbreaking, and it's just amazing, you know. But the whole movie, I don't know, it's just stuck in my head.
I don't know how I made it through, you know, 2 years of film school and I've never seen this. I mean, it's very critically acclaimed.
It's the fucking shit. And Jim Jarmusch did a few movies back then. Stranger Than Paradise was right before that. And that one's too atmospheric for me. It's too spaced out. There's not a lot of dialogue. There's a lot of like, this is back when you make a movie where you just like aim the camera at two interesting looking people and they would just like lay in a bed. And you're like, but everyone's like, wow. Cause they're like, those people are so cool. But Down by Law was that perfect mix of like, there's a plot and dialogue and it's funny, but you know, also it's very artsy.
Yeah, and he's done some interesting things. I'll say Ghost Dog.
Ghost Dog was great. That was like a mainstream. Yeah.
Was that the follow up to Ghost Dad? It was the spin off to Bill Cosby's dog.
Yeah. Broken Flowers with Bill Murray. Great.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Jim Jarmusch, he's not a fucking lightweight.
Yeah.
You know?
No, he's got a lot of great fucking movies in his.
Here's the thing about Jim Jarmusch, though. He's like the equivalent of. He's like a Built to Spill or like a Dinosaur Jr. where it's like chicks don't care. It's like women just don't. It's just white men, white hipster dudes that are just really into a guy. You know what I mean? It's like it doesn't take away from how great they are, in my opinion, but it's very just like one voice and it's, you know.
Yeah, kind of like John Waters.
Well, what do you mean by that? Because I feel like John Waters had a very broad... Not broad, that's true. But like a very specific. He spoke for a minor voice.
Yeah.
Jim Jarmusch spoke for like a culture snob white guy.
That's true.
High fidelity type aesthetic. You know.
Well, I mean.
But I'm still a sucker for it. Yeah. I can't stop. I can't watch and go, that doesn't appeal to me. I fucking love it. You know. It's weird. It's annoying.
It's one of those that like you can rewatch over and over again, which is probably why it's your favorite.
Yeah.
And I know, like, I'm looking at some of the fun facts here. Nicoletta Bracci, she was, who plays the Italian woman, is Robert Baggini's wife in real life.
Oh, my God, I forgot. That scene where they fight is so funny.
Yeah, tell us about it.
Well, it's just, so they're on the road after they escape from this New Orleans prison. And they're all, like, overnight guys that got busted for, you know, public drunkenness or whatever. And they all bust out together. And I believe, and I haven't seen this movie in a long time, but I believe that there's like almost like a magical realism situation where they like literally physically bust out of the wall of the prison. Something that's like impossible, you know, but like it's just to move the movie along. So now they're like running and Roberto Benigni is the dork that's like, you know, that old Warner Brothers cartoon that was like Pip and the big dog and the little dog and the little dog was like, hey, Spark, hey, what are we doing? What are we doing? What are we doing? You know, and the big dog was like, shut up. I don't remember that fucking. Roberto Benigni was the excited little dog that was like, you know, John Lurie and Tom Waits were these like hard drinking, you know, womenizing musician outlaws. And then Roberto Benigni was like this like simpleton, happy, excited puppy, you know? And he was like, we can all hang out, right? After they're like escaping together and they're like, ugh. No. And he's like, well, I know where we can, there's a house. And they were like, all right, fine. So they go with him and it's his lady's house. And then she cooks them dinner. And it's like this really sweet, like little family moment with these outlaws, you know?
Yeah.
And I love movies that have those scenes where people who don't really have a home and are either outlaws or like real outlaws or you know, never have a sense of security or stability in their lives. Find like an hour of peace, you know.
Yeah,
I love those scenes. It seems to be a scene that happens quite a bit in movies, where these characters that have no other haven end up together for 1 second, where it's like safe for a minute, and then it's all hell fucking breaks loose after
that. Every other episode of The Walking Dead.
Yeah, that's like the shitty version of it, but like yeah, it's actually a huge part cut out of Apocalypse Now. The director's cut, it's in there where, you know, they go have a dinner at this like French colonialist house or whatever. But I'm probably boring the shit out of your podcast people, but
no, this is what they live for.
This is what they tune in for.
No, like what's so funny is Apocalypse Now is what, like 2.5 hours long? And like, the director's cut. It's like, which I now own 4 hours long.
Oh yeah, that's right. Shit.
Now featuring a 90-minute conversation about politics in Vietnam, like around a fucking table of a French lord. It's so boring. But so that's a bad example. But anyway, so they go to Roberto Benigni's wife's house, and then they go out into the, and I don't, you know, it's been so long since I've seen this movie. It just always stuck in my head as like something that really mattered to me, you know, when I was younger. And they, It's basically these guys that don't want to have anything to do with each other. They're all lone. They're lone wolves. They end up in prison because they're lone wolves. They're guys that can't follow the rules or socialize, and now they have to like work together to get away. You know, and then the last scene. I don't want to spoil it, but you can't spoil an art movie.
Yeah.
And it's from 1986, so if it's spoiled,
you should have seen it.
Yeah.
But there's a fork in the road, and Benigni's gone. I forget where he... I think he ends up with his chick or whatever. And John Laurie and Tom Waits are at this fork, literal fork in the road. And as an audience, you're like, fucking go together. Like, you guys are obviously soulmates and should be best friends and make albums. And then they fucking take both separate roads. They decide to go back to being alone, you know, after the whole brotherhood experience. And that's like a... That was very poignant for me. Do you say the G in poignant? Poignant?
I don't know. Into the T in half the things here in Utah, so I don't know about G's.
I don't.
But maybe that's the sentiment that stayed with me, is that they ended up going down their own roads even after they bonded that hard.
Yeah.
They're like, we all die alone anyway, and I have my own vision. You know?
Yeah.
And I probably felt in college like I would have been like, well, let's go together down the same road and see if we can start a diner, you know?
Yeah.
And these two visionaries were like, well, no, we're going to go to, you know, so.
Well, I know one thing interesting about this is Roberto Benigni had never been to America prior to this film.
Oh, his English was so funny. So funny. It's great. He's so good. He's like, he's tremendous in that movie. He really is. I mean, he's the scene, that scene with the rabbit. If I don't know if it's on YouTube, just the scene with the rabbit, but yeah. Like, if you're listening to this, just go watch. If you don't have time to watch a masterpiece, watch 5 minutes.
Well, they're even saying that the Roberto Rabbit soliloquy was almost entirely self-written, improvised.
Oh, yeah, it was improvised.
Yeah, based.
Yeah,
yeah. Which is insane.
Absolutely.
Like,
well, that's because he was a master where he was from.
Yeah.
He's like one of those Korean guys that's like, I'm a surgeon. And then he comes to America and he's like, I manage a 7-Eleven. that was Roberto Benigni in Down by Law, where like he was like a fucking phenomenal talent in Italy. And then he came and did this.
And it sounds like a beautiful film, too. Just, you know, looking at a great cast.
It opens with Ellen Barkin is Tom Waits' girlfriend.
Yeah.
And they wake up in a shithole apartment in New Orleans, and she's pissed. She's like mad that he's not making something of himself. And I forget how he gets arrested, but like basically they get into a fight, and then he gets arrested, and that's you know, he gets taken to jail, and that's how it starts. But like Ellen Barkin was in it, you know, when she's sexy, holy shit. I don't know, you remember young Ellen Barkin with her fucking crooked face? It's awesome.
I don't, but I need to know it now.
You should look it up.
Down by Law is on Hulu.
Is it?
So,
oh, nice.
Yeah, anybody that has Hulu.
It's also one of those posters that if you have it in your apartment and bring a girl home, they go, oh, Christ.
Everything here is going to be gluten-free.
Yeah, well, not gluten-free, but it's like everything. Like, I'm never going to be right in any arguments, and I'm going to – my bands suck. Like, you know, if you walk into a guy's apartment and he's got a Down by Law poster, like, you're just – get ready for an argument no matter what you're going to talk about.
I would actually be curious, because I mean, from what I'm seeing here is just the Criterion Collection cover of it, just them in the jail cell. It's all like a unique kind of like weird pose, like one of them's just leaning again, the other's looking off to the left.
Wow.
Well, there's also, I mean, this whole like movie looks. I need to watch it just if
it's
on Hulu.
It's on Hulu. I'm set.
That's what I love about technology. You can find something somewhere.
You know what's exciting is, for your listeners right now, is now I'm going to go home and watch that on Hulu.
Really?
Yeah, because for the longest time, you couldn't find this movie. You'd have to get it on like a Criterion DVD or like whatever, but it wasn't like...
Oh, well, duh, that's why Hulu has it then, because they have the whole Criterion collection.
See, I forgot
about that. But they,
yeah,
I didn't even think about that.
How are the ads on those?
If it's a movie, there's no ads.
Oh, there isn't?
There's the ones right beforehand.
Really?
Because I've watched a few on there. Maybe it's just because I have Hulu Plus.
I feel like Criterion, they'd be real sons of bitches to break that
up. I
want to
say they had some at the beginning and had some at the end, but it's been a while since I've watched a movie on there, so I might be totally wrong.
Yeah.
But I don't recall there being commercials when I watched
the
movie.
I forgot that Hulu had the entire Criterion collection.
Yeah, I totally forgot about that, too. Good old Rushmore.
Watch that. Oh, man, that's a great movie.
Fuck, I love that movie so much.
Movie. I think I just lost my weekend now that I'm reminded of this.
And I love Wes Anderson, but I feel like consistency-wise in terms of who's been putting movies together for the last 20 years. I feel guilty saying this because it's so obvious and white guy mainstream, but the Coen brothers, I mean, just like, the only thing they're missing in their movies is heart, which sounds like a big missing piece.
Yeah.
You know, it's a pretty big missing piece. And they are missing it. There isn't a whole lot of heart in Coen brothers movies, and that's why they're not more mainstream. That's why Spielberg sells $400 million on his opening weekend, you know, and the Coen brothers do, you know, $60 million because they're more of a intellectual type, you know. You're never inside the character.
Except for Ted Llewyn Davis.
Very true.
Except for the one movie where the title is "You're inside the character." That was a very good joke.
It's the only way that we can get them.
But man, I mean, so satisfying. The Big Lebowski is probably my second favorite movie of all time.
I feel like there's aggressive Miller's heart Crossing. In that movie.
Oh, Brother, Where Art Thou?
Yeah.
Oh, Brother, I mentioned it before when I talked about Down by Law.
Yeah.
Oh, Brother, Where Art Thou is like Down by Law with Roots music. It's like the same fucking plot, essentially.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Like, what's his name? I know his name.
George Clooney? Crazy.
No, the dumb one.
Fuck.
I can never remember their names. I just always remember the line.
John Turturro, George Clooney, and then fucking...
The other guy.
Good.
He was the voice of Monkey Bone. That's I always forget, but I know he's
dead. The internet.
Anyway, he's Benigni.
Yeah.
He's the Benigni.
Oh, nice.
And then George Clooney and John Turturro are, you know, John Laurie and Tom Waits.
Nice.
Yeah. It's almost exactly the same movie.
Yeah, just minus the...
budget and, you know, black and white.
But sometimes a low-budget black
Tim
and white
Blake
movies
is
great.
His name.
Tim Blake.
Tim Blake Nelson, yeah.
Fuck.
I just always think of the line of, Delmer, we thought you was a toad.
Yeah.
That's all I ever go back
to. Get a wizard, change him back. No, my favorite Tim Blake Nelson line is in that movie is, gopher? They're eating gopher out of fire. He offers them gopher. And then obviously the best line by George Clooney is, my hair. He wakes up every time. The first thing he's worried about is his hair.
Yeah, he has his, what is it, Dapper Dan?
Dapper Dan. I'm a Dapper Dan man, damn it.
I can't remember that much about a movie I haven't seen in 15 years.
Yeah.
We got Pomade.
I always liked him in that, but honestly, I'm going to sound like a weirdo, but my favorite George Clooney movie is From Dusk Till Dawn.
I haven't seen that in a while.
That's always been the ones that
he's
I liked
in
that? Yeah.
I knew Selma Hayek was in it. That's who I associate with.
Yeah,
that movie.
Him, Tarantino are in it. Fucking, I always forget her name.
Is that a good
name.
Movie?
I like it. It's one of my favorite vampire movies. Mm. Which nowadays, it's fucking, we're in the sunlight. We're glittering like
metrosexuals. Yeah, we're in love.
Yeah.
Remember when vampires used to kill people? Remember those days?
Or they burst into flames in the sun.
Here's a real pretentious confession.
Sure.
I got real into Nosferatu in college.
Nice.
I loved that movie. Like, all the way through. Silent movie. I used to put my own soundtracks on. You know how you'd match up Dark Side of the Moon with Wizard of Oz?
Yeah.
I used to match up my own albums with Nosferatu. That's what a fucking piece of shit I was. I'd bring my roommates in and be like,
part of that just blew my mind.
Yeah.
What?
Part of that just blew my mind.
Yeah.
Because now I'm going to try to do it.
Yeah,
I actually have that in my Netflix.
Well,
really?
Yeah.
I'm really good. Here's the thing. In the stand-up community, no one knows because of my hair or whatever that I am a deeply rooted indie snob piece of shit. I look like I'm into the Spice Girls and like whatever. But I used to match up Nosferatu with Godspeed You Black Emperor had a album called Raise Your Hands to Heaven, and it was an instrumental album by a prog rock group. In 2003. Oh, Jesus Christ. So anyway, I had it on vinyl, obviously. I'm basically Jonah Ray inside, but Jonah Ray has to be Jonah Ray outside, so he wins. And every time I have a conversation with Jonah Ray, we're like the same person. Like there's no space in between the talking. It's just like we're the same guy. But he looks like the guy, and I don't look like the guy, so he gets to be the guy. So anyway, that's what branding is. So... I used to match up Godspeed You Black Emperor with Nosferatu, and it worked perfectly. It was fucking amazing, you know? And I would try to bring in, I'd get super high, and I would bring in my roommates, and they'd be like, what are you doing? I'm like, watch this silent movie matched up to a band you don't know. They'd be like, or I'd rather go to class than deal with that.
Oh, I was like that too. And I actually don't mind the John Malkovich version of it.
Of Nosferatu?
Yeah, where they like basically it's the behind the scenes where they're showing the movie being made.
Oh, what was that?
Oh, something Shadow of the Vampire? Is that what it is?
Yeah. I think it was called Shadow of the Vampire. I never saw it, but I remember it.
I always liked that. I always thought it was a nice kind of twist because Nosferatu in that movie is a real vampire. Yeah. So they hired a real vampire to play that in the silent film. And then you got John Malkovich, who's fucking great in most anything he's in.
And might be a vampire.
It's true.
mean, if anyone's a vampire, John Malkovich is a vampire.
Him or Nicolas Cage.
Nicolas Cage is not a vampire. He's a Highlander.
I like that. He's absorbed all
he's
the Coppola.
He's too confident. I don't know. He's too out. Vampires are sleek and under the scenes. You know what I mean? They're like behind the scenes kind of thing. Nicolas Cage is like, hello. You know, he's like way too.
Oh, anytime I think 80s or older vampire, I jump to Vampire's Kiss with him. Which if you've never seen that movie, fucking.
Vampire. Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, it's great.
Insane movie.
I jumped to Valley Girl.
Oh, yeah.
He wasn't a vampire, but he had his original teeth. I don't know if you remember. Because Nick Cage got Hollywood teeth. That's the thing that, you know, changed his whole face.
But yeah.
Valley Girl, he's still got the big gums and the tiny teeth.
Oh,
he's got
that's right.
Hey, you guys. He's got that mouth for Valley Girl.
Oh, man. That's like remembering.
Chunk? Is that his name? No.
Sloth. Sloth. Yeah.
He's got sloth teeth in Valley Girl.
That's like remembering what Renee Zellweger's face used to look like before the surgery.
Oh, it's so sad. I know. So pretty.
Jennifer Grey. Yeah, that's true. I thought Renee Zellweger was hot in Bridget Jones's Diary.
She's still hot. She's just a different woman who's also hot.
It's true. It's like, Rupert Everett like did the same thing with his face, too, and he's a totally different person.
Yeah.
So weird. I never got that. Like, you're a symbol, you know, everyone knows your face. But you're like, hey, I'm just going to cut it the fuck up and change everything. Why not? Maybe I've thought way too much into this.
I think you might have.
Probably.
Granted, I get it to a degree because, I mean, I've got, like, my teeth. I mean, you mentioned Nicolas Cage's Hollywood teeth. I've had braces and everything, but I've got little teeny tiny teeth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I still have these little gaps. And every time.
You have an adorable mouth, which sounds like a very pedophile thing to say.
Which is great because we're in an enclosed room. We'll know how you scream.
But there you go. But I always get self-conscious of that, especially when I'm in L.A., and, like, I'll see somebody that's homeless, and I'm like, that homeless guy's got better teeth than I do. Like, I have to say, L.A. has very handsome homeless.
Yeah. Well, they always have six-packs and shit. It's weird. Yeah. It's very weird. Well, because image is everything.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. I've never seen a pretty homeless person until, like, I was at Tracks the other day, and this girl, she looked very cute, but she comes up to me, and she's just like, I'll do whatever you want for a train ticket. And I'm like, sounds like a great...
So you got blown yesterday.
No.
Why didn't you do it?
It was weird. It seemed very weird that you'd walk up to anybody and say, hey, I'll do anything for
a
train ticket.
What physical circumstances would you have had to been in where you would have done it?
Where I would have done it?
Yeah. Like, because you were on the street. I feel like you were nervous that you were in public.
Yeah.
But I feel like if the same woman came up to you and you were, like, near your house or something, and, like, access would have made a huge difference to you.
I feel like, as paranoid as I am, I still feel like I would have been fearful of gonorrhea even while I was doing it.
Yeah, but gonorrhea goes away.
Maybe she had AIDS.
Screens for that.
AIDS.
If she's offering it to, if she's offering that to me, she's done it 50 times.
No, I know. I'm just fucking with you. But it's an interesting.
I kind of just want to, like, drop you off on, like, the Sunset Strip, like down by, like, the rainbow.
Yeah.
Just be like, go for it, Christopher. Just go on. just see how many offers you get.
It is a very scary world. It's street looking is not something.
Well, what makes me nervous is I've had a woman on a train say, hey, can I have an Altoid? My mouth tastes like dick. You know? Which makes me nervous to even try to do something with someone like that.
Yeah. Well, because you're looking for love.
Or you know, someone who will accept my flaws.
I'd be more confused if they're coming to you like that, if they've got something caught in their throat, or if they just have, like, a bad smoke or something, if their mouth tastes like dick.
Yeah, there's residue dick.
Hey, there are other things that make your mouth taste like dick besides dick. You know, maybe she just, you know, it was a
coincidence. She had some bad time or something. I don't know.
It sounds to me like you're too picky is what's going on.
A little, yeah. That's why I'm destined to get a cat.
I'm just looking for a nice lady whose mouth doesn't taste like dick.
Who won't offer to give
when
me sexual favors.
When we say hello to each other.
I want a meet cute, not a meet and creepy.
Yeah.
You know?
I hear that.
I'll fuck you for a train ticket. How far are you going? I'll call you an Uber. How about that? Then we fall in love, and our kids are just born crack babies.
And then you name your kids Uber and
Uber and Lyft
and one Lyft. Way.
Oh my god! Well, Julian, we are nearing our mark, sir.
Okay.
Do you
We've
have
satisfied
any...
the sponsors?
Oh, I'm so super satisfied.
Okay.
As I'm sure Club of 50 West will be for this. Awesome opportunity, not only to have you on the podcast, but do it in the green room, too.
Yeah, this was great.
It was always
very comfortable.
Yeah.
Walked off stage after talking for an hour to talk for an hour. And
it was, which I feel still a great audience. I
can't imagine what else I would want to do more right after a set than talk for an hour.
And then you get very limited sleep to get up and talk for several more hours.
Yeah. Well, do you have anything coming up that you want to promote or anything... I'm just distracted like, what's happening.
How
right.
about I have let's see, wait, what date is it? What's today?
Today is the 12th.
Of November?
Yeah.
So I have I guess the next club I'll promote. I'm doing the comedy scene in Boston in early December. So you can come see that. I'm doing Sketchfest in San Francisco.
Oh nice.
In January.
I think I'm coming out the opening weekend.
Oh good. That's awesome.
Because then Sundance is like the second weekend, and I'm
yeah,
pissed
yeah.
about that.
Here's what I'll pitch. I just started my first podcast.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. 2015. I feel like it's a good time.
Why not?
It's going to be called Don't Look Back, and it's a podcast where we look back. And I interview comedian friends of mine about what they would have done if they weren't doing stand-up.
Nice.
And then we book someone who does that career, and then we interview that person. So
oh, awesome.
Our first episode is John Gabris, who's an improv comedian, was going to be an FBI agent in high school, he thought. So we booked a retired FBI agent, and John and I interview that agent about what it's like to be an FBI agent.
Oh, that's awesome.
So that's
really
my
cool.
podcast.
It's a cool concept.
And it's on Howl, which is Wolf, Earwolf's paid.
Yeah.
It's their paywall. But it, for $5, you get access to every podcast that's ever put out by Wolf Pop or Earwolf or whatever, and you can also get exclusive podcasts like mine, and Lauren Lapkus has one on there, and you know
Lauren
like
Lapkus
that.
Her podcast is just hilarious.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's always an interview with her.
Yeah so yeah, that look for that. I'll be releasing that, and probably we did the episode, so it'll probably come out in about 2 weeks.
Nice.
Yeah,
no, it sounds
that
like a badass podcast.
And John and the FBI agent. Yeah,
nice. I can't wait
and
to
the
hear
next
that.
One will be Paul F. Tompkins is going to
oh,
be
nice.
a trial lawyer, so we're going to interview a trial lawyer about what it's like to be a trial lawyer.
And I love Paul F. Tompkins.
Oh,
I met
yeah.
him for the first time at San Diego Comic-Con and didn't know what to really expect, and he's the biggest sweetheart in the entire
oh,
world.
Oh, he's very nice.
Yeah.
Very nice. But yeah, every time I talk to him, even now, and I haven't done this podcast with him yet, and I hopefully I calm down by then, but I... it's like, in terms of the two sides of comedy, for me, like... the top, it's Patrice O'Neill on one side and then Paul F. Tompkins on the other. Like those are the two styles that you could do
yeah
at the best that you can do them is, you know, confrontational, like social justice that no one agrees with but by Patrice O'Neill, and then absurd storytelling, you know, just brilliant wordplay and all that by Paul. So those
nice.
Are my two favorite guys.
Awesome.
So
I
hopefully
can't...
I keep it together for my podcast.
I can't wait to
like
hear it.
Ask him what it's like to be Paul all the time.
No, we'll definitely plug that as well. And Twitter, Facebook, you got any
at Jules Mac on Twitter, right. And I don't give a shit anymore. I'm either gonna get famous on TV or nothing's gonna happen.
Oh no, we did that. Yeah. Well, Julian, I want to thank you so much for doing the podcast and
sure.
You know, of course, if you're hearing this, check him out at 50 West tomorrow at 7 and 9, and of course Saturday, 7 and 9:30 as well. So be sure to check that out. Follow him on Twitter. You can also follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/trustyournerds. on Twitter at TrustYourNerds. And if you have a recommendation for a theme or a movie, email us at TrustYourMovieNerds.com. Or sorry, TrustYourMovieNerds@gmail.com. And then, of course, I want to thank my guest co-host again, Mr. Tim Drake.
Of course. Thanks for having me back.
Nope.
Tim Drake Nelson, we call him. Because he's the simpleton in our prison break.
That's Tim, where can people find you online as well?
On Twitter, at Tim Drake. On Instagram, at Tim Drake 42, because some asshole already had at Tim Drake.
41 of their assholes.
Yeah, 42 just was my lucky number, so I didn't try. Oh, yeah. I just went with the 42 as soon as I saw at Tim Drake was taken on Instagram. But yeah, and then at On the Mic Podcast, onthemicpodcast.com has all the episodes on there, and yeah.
Nice. And be sure to follow Club at 50 West at 50 West SLC for, of course, Julian's remaining shows and all the other great comedians coming to town. Live recordings of podcasts and local stand-up comedy, too. So I've been your host, Christopher James. Have a great night, everybody.